Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So think about this. 30% of the human genome, which is around 1 billion base pairs, was essentially written by a single self-propagating copy-paste machine.
Yeah, 1 billion base pairs, just relentlessly amplifying itself throughout our entire evolutionary history.
Right. But what really happens when this ancient genetic machine goes rogue, accidentally copying pieces of different genetic instructions and fusing them together into completely new hybrid genes?
Well, I mean, it forces us to look at those billion base pairs not just as some inert historical archive, you know, but really as a highly dynamic engine of recombination.
Exactly. Today's deep dive is an exploration into a new paper that maps these ancient genetic mashups. Our mission is to understand the mechanics of how these rare chimeric fusions happen and how they might be the secret engine driving mammalian evolution.
It's a massive topic. And before we get into the molecular mechanics, we definitely need to acknowledge the researchers behind this.
For sure. Today, we celebrate the work of Chuk-Ting Law and Kathleen H. Burns from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and Harvard Medical School, who have advanced our understanding of retrotransposons and genomic evolution. So to start, we really need to look closely at the core machinery driving all this, which is line one.
Right, line one, or long interspersed element one. It's a retrotransposon that has been active in mammalian genomes for, over 170 million years.
Which is an incredibly long time to be jumping around.
Oh, absolutely. And to understand how it creates these fusions, we have to look at its primary copying mechanism. So line one produces an RNA intermediate, right? And that translates into two proteins, ORF1P and ORF2P.
And ORF2P is the really critical player here, right? Because it has both endonucleus and reverse transcriptase activity.
Exactly. It's the workhorse. The process is called target primed reverse transcription, or TPRT.
Let's actually look at the physical logistics of how that operates on the chromatin. So ORF2P has to find a specific sequence, which is usually a T-rich region, and physically nick the bottom strand of the DNA.
Yeah, that nick is the defining event. By cutting the DNA backbone, the endonucleus exposes a free 3' hydroxyl group.
Right.
And then the line one RNA binds to the P-rich sequence right at the nick, and the reverse transcriptase uses that free hydroxyl group as basically a primer to start synthesizing a new DNA strand directly from the RNA template.
So it is literally building a new piece of DNA base by base right into the chromosomal
branch. Way at it, that's exactly what's happening.
But usually, I mean, it just copies its own line one RNA. The focus of today's deep dive is what happens when something else gets caught in that polymerization process, right? Creating a bipartite insertion or a chimera.
Yeah, and the challenge for genomicists hasn't really been conceptualizing that this happens. It's actually finding these chimeras in the genome.
Because of how degraded they get over time.
Exactly. Millions of years of sequence degradation, newer overlapping mutations, and, you know, nested transposable elements jumping into older ones. It just makes the historical record incredibly fragmented.
So how did researchers normally look for them before this paper?
Historically, they relied on a pretty biased approach using bait sequences.
Okay, meaning they had to know what they were looking for.
Right. Like, if they suspected a highly transcribed non-coding RNA, like the U6 small nuclear RNA, was forming chimeras, they would computationally scan the genome specifically for U6 sequences sitting right next to line one elements.
I mean, the inherent limitation there is obvious, right? You only find the fusions you already suspect exist. If you use U6 as bait, you only catch U6.
Exactly. It's like fishing with a lure that only attracts one type of fish. To map the true landscape of these fusions, the researchers had to abandon the bait sequence method entirely.
And that's where their new computational pipeline comes in. Timestamp.
Yes, timestamp. Instead of searching for specific known sequences, they basically anchored their search in evolutionary time.
Which is a huge paradigm shift.
Oh.
How does timestamp actually do that?
Well, it leverages multiple sequence alignments, or MSA. They analyzed 464 genome assemblies across 438 distinct mammalian species.
Wow, that is a massive data set.
It is, and by aligning these highly conserved syntony blocks across all those genomes, the pipeline identifies orthologous loci, basically, regions of the genome that descended from the exact same ancestral sequence.
Okay, so they're looking for insertions that appear contemporaneously, right? Like at the exact same evolutionary time in the specific branch of the evolutionary tree.
Exactly.
So it's like comparing different editions of a textbook published over millions of years. Instead of searching for specific typos, you're looking for the exact edition where a new paragraph and an illustration were suddenly added side by side.
That is a perfect analogy. Yeah. Yes. And it allowed the team to pinpoint 12 distinct evolutionary time points for these insertions, completely independent of prior bait sequences.
So wait, I want to challenge the methodology there for a second. When you're looking at an MSA of hundreds of species, how does the algorithm definitively distinguish between a chimeric sequence that was inserted at a specific evolutionary node versus, say, a sequence that is much older but just happened to get deleted in subsequent lineages?
Yeah, that is a really crucial distinction, yeah. The algorithm relies on the principle of maximum parsimony combined with structural signatures.
Maximum parsimony meaning the simplest explanation is usually the right one.
Right. So if a sequence is absent in distant outgroups, let's say marsupials and monotremes, but it's uniformly present in a specific clade of placental mammals, it requires way fewer evolutionary assumptions to classify it as a single insertion event at the base of that clade, rather than multiple independent deletion events across all the outgroups.
That still makes sense.
Plus, true line one insertions leave structural hallmarks, like target site duplications, which really help verify that it was a retrotranspositional event and not just a complex deletion.
Okay, so taking the blinders off with this timestamp method allowed them to compile this massive catalog of over 700 chimeric events.
Yeah, and while they recovered the known ones, like the U6 and 5S RNA fusions, they discovered a vast array of completely novel line one partners.
Like what? What else did they find?
The pipeline identified tRNAs, 28S RNAs, 7SL RNAs, yRNAs, and 7SK RNAs.
That's a lot of different RNAs getting hijacked. But the structural data regarding the tRNA fusions is particularly striking to me. They identified 21 specific tRNA and line 1 chimeras, but the tRNAs incorporated weren't full-length molecules, they were exactly half-length.
Yes, exactly half.
Wait, why specifically half a tRNA? I mean, is the cell intentionally cutting them up before they get pasted?
Actually, yes. It connects directly to known biology. Cellular enzymes, like RNase P2 and angiogenin, they don't just degrade RNA randomly. During cellular stress, they specifically cleave mature tRNAs right at the anticodon loop.
Splitting them into discrete 5' and 3' halves.
Exactly. Like during oxidative stress, amino acid starvation, or even a viral infection.
But what is the physiological purpose of cleaving tRNAs during a crisis? Are they intentionally trying to halt translation?
Yeah, that's a primary function. These tRNA halves can interact with the translation initiation machinery or even associate with stress granules, effectively repressing global protein synthesis.
Which conserves cellular energy during the stressor.
Right. So what this paper reveals is that the line one machinery is just highly opportunistic. It's capturing these abundant stress-induced tRNA fragments floating around the cytoplasm and bringing them into the nucleus to be reverse transcribed.
That is wild.
Yeah.
But the structural orientation of how they are pasted, that's where the mechanics get really highly complex. These tRNA halves are overwhelmingly pasted in the antisense orientation. So basically backwards relative to the line one sequence.
Yeah, backwards. And to achieve that, the researchers proposed this fascinating mechanism called twin priming.
Let's walk through the physical logistics of that, because we have the initial endonuclease NIC on the bottom strand priming the line one RNA. So how do two simultaneous copying mechanisms meet in the middle without just unraveling the local chromatin structure?
So during TTRT, after the bottom strand is nicked and line one synthesis begins, a second nick eventually has to occur on the top strand to resolve the insertion, right?
To finish the job.
Well, in twin priming, that top strand nick serves as a secondary priming site. While the main line one RNA is being reverse transcribed from the bottom nick, a totally separate RNA molecule, in this case, the tRNA half anneals to the top strand nick.
Oh, wow. So the reverse transcriptase complex begins polymerizing the tRNA sequence from the top nick, moving in the opposite direction.
Exactly. Two distinct polymerases, or maybe the same complex operating bidirectionally, synthesizing towards each other.
And when the two replication forks collide, the host repair machinery ligates them together, locking the tRNA half in a backwards orientation.
It is a brilliant deduction from the structural evidence, isn't it?
It really is. And moving beyond small non-coding RNAs, the pipeline also detected 452 chimeric insertions involving ALU elements, which is another famous jumping gene.
Yeah, ALU is a non-autonomous transposable element. It doesn't have its own machinery, so it relies entirely on the line 1 ORF2P protein to jump.
Because ALU elements vastly outnumber line 1 in the human genome, there must be an intense competition for that ORF2P machinery.
Absolutely. And the timestamp pipeline provided incredible temporal resolution for these fusions. Like, 77% of these ALU fusions mapped to what they designate as time point 7.
Which corresponds to the period just before the divergence of new and old world monkeys, right? Roughly 60 million years ago.
Yep, 60 million years ago.
So if we look at the evolutionary context of the Paleocene epoch back then, what drove this massive surge in retrotransposition?
Well, the kinetics suggest severe environmental or evolutionary bottlenecks. When we analyze the specific families of ALU and line 1 involved, the data shows that in nearly 83% of these cases, the exact families forming the chimeras were experiencing a population surge.
They were actively transcribing and jumping at the exact same evolutionary moment.
Exactly. They were directly competing for the line 1 pasting machinery.
Which makes sense. I mean, stress induces retrotransposon activity. If early primates were facing massive environmental shifts, their epigenetic suppression mechanisms might have weakened.
Right, and the ALU transcripts and the line 1 transcripts were just flooding the nuclear territory simultaneously.
Aggressively competing for limited ORF2P binding sites. And when both transcripts interact with the same TPRT complex at a genomic nick, you get these massive fusion events.
Yeah, the density of transcripts directly influences the error rate of the reverse transcription process. But here's the thing, because timestamp was unbiased, it didn't just find repetitive junk DNA fusions.
Right, it actually found 17 discrete instances where actual protein-coding mRNAs or long non-coding RNAs fused with line 1.
Which is huge.
The specific examples they mentioned, the MAP3K13 and EKHIT genes, are remarkable because of precisely which parts of the host genes were captured. In these instances, the very first exon of the host gene was spliced flawlessly onto a nearly full-length protein-coding line 1 element.
Yeah, we are looking at a mechanism called transplicing there.
But how does the host spliceosome, which is usually so highly regulated, confuse a line 1 transcript with a host gene's own downstream exons?
Well, splicing is essentially driven by physical proximity and sequence motifs, mostly splice donor and acceptor sites. In the densely packed environment of a transcription factory inside the nucleus, multiple genes and transposable elements can be transcribed in really close spatial proximity.
Okay, so they're literally just bumping into each other.
Pretty much. And if a line 1 transcript possesses a strong splice acceptor site, and it is floating near an actively transcribing host gene, like MAP3K13, the spliceosome complex can just mistakenly ligate the 5' splice donor of the host's first exon directly to the line 1 RNA.
So it's basically like a spam email accidentally acquiring the official letterhead of the CEO. Because it has the CEO's header, it completely bypasses the spam filters.
I love that. Yes, exactly. By stealing the 5' end of a gene, the line 1 sequence is essentially co-opting the host gene's promoter and regulatory binding sites.
It acquires this highly complex, pre-approved structural format that dictates exactly when and where the transcript should be expressed.
And that promoter acquisition alters the regulatory landscape completely. By capturing it, the line 1 element frees itself from its own internal regulatory constraints, and it falls under the control of the host's regulatory network.
Which brings us to the RAP1-GDS1 case, which I think serves as a really powerful demonstration of promoter co-option in action. Like a zombie line 1.
Oh, totally a zombie line 1. So the researchers found a specific line 1 element, an L1PA2 family member, situated right inside an intron of the RAP1-GDS1 gene.
And this particular L1PA2 had a massive deletion at its 5' end, right? Entirely removing its internal promoter.
Right. So on its own, this line 1 sequence was transcriptionally dead. Completely dead. It lacked the capacity to recruit RNA polymerase and initiate transcription at all.
Yet it hijacked the highly active promoter of the RAP1-GDS1 host gene. Because it resides within that gene, the powerful promoter drives expression right through the intron.
Exactly. And through splicing, that expression is just force-fed into the truncated line 1.
The fusion transcript restores the line 1's ability to produce functional proteins, essentially reviving a dead sequence.
And here's the crazy part. RAP1-GDS1 exhibits high expression levels in specific tissues, predominantly the brain and the testis.
So the host gene's promoter profile restricts this revived line 1 activity precisely to those tissues.
Yes. And the researchers even validated this by querying modern long-read sequencing datasets. They found definitive evidence of this exact RAP1-GDS1 line 1 chimeric RNA actively circulating in human brain tissue today.
That is just incredible to think about. We really have to analyze why this matters, like why promoter swapping is such a critical survival mechanism for retrotransposons, especially considering the intense defenses our host cells deploy against them.
Yeah, the host cell utilizes very sophisticated epigenetic silencing machinery to suppress line 1 activity. Complexes like the HUSH or human silencing hub, alongside targeted DNA methylation, they're specifically designed to recognize the structural signatures of the line 1 promoter.
Basically locking it down.
Exactly. Methyltransferases add methyl groups to the cytosines in the line 1 promoter, which recruits reader proteins that tightly coil the local chromatin into heterochromatin. This physically compacts the DNA, totally blocking RNA polymerase from accessing the sequence.
So the silencing machinery acts as a structural padlock. But the target of that padlock is the native line 1 promoter.
Right.
If a line 1 element utilizes transplicing or intronic trapping to swap its native promoter for a diverse RNA or a host genes promoter, it bypasses the padlock entirely.
Exactly the case. The host cell cannot simply methylate and silence the RAP1 GDS1 promoter because the cell absolutely requires the RAP1 GDS1 protein for neural development and function.
So by hiding behind an essential host promoter, the line 1 element evades heterochromatin formation and maintains its expression. It leverages the cell's own essential architecture against the silencing mechanisms.
It's remarkably insidious. However, I should point out the researchers are careful to note the limitations of the current study.
Right, because the timestamp pipeline relies heavily on the quality of the underlying genome alignments.
Yeah, when you are constructing alignments across highly divergent clades, like comparing placental mammals to marsupials, homologous repetitive regions can be misaligned, creating computational artifacts.
So what's the next step?
Well, the bioinformatic evidence for transplicing and twin priming is really robust, but the next vital phase requires experimental validation. Recreating these specific cellular stressors in controlled in vitro environments to directly observe the kinetics of twin priming or the specific error rates of the spliceosome during transplicing that will be critical to verifying these mechanisms.
To really distill the central insight from all of this, line 1 is not merely a mindless repetitive element passively accumulating mutations. It is a highly dynamic engine of recombination. By fusing with diverse host RNAs, from stress-cleaved tRNA fragments to complex protein-coding mRNAs, line 1 constantly generates novel genetic architectures that have profoundly shaped mammalian evolution.
Absolutely. It totally challenges the paradigm of genomic stability, demonstrating that the genome is continually experimenting with its own structural components over millions of years.
So what does this mean for how we view the so-called junk DNA inside our cells? If these retrotransposition events are highly active in neural tissue, driven by promoters like RAP1 GDS1, we must consider the ongoing impact. Could these rogue copy-paste fusions be happening in your brain right now, subtly altering the genomic architecture of individual neurons, or contributing to the unique, complex wiring of your mind?
That is a fascinating thought to leave on.
This episode was based on an open-access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base. The past become a track to run, borrowed space.
stitches through ages of strain. Signatures linger like heat in the rain. tRNA, 7SL, and the long 28 swipe.